and death. Episode 7, the finale, it's over, but we're just getting started. I'm holding the line, I'm Sarah Carradine, and will you still love me tomorrow, LaTonya Starks?
I think so. All signs point to yes.
Good, even though I made you watch this show.
I feel like it was mutual on both of our parts until we saw the first episode.
Exactly. So we're recapping Love and Death with full spoilers. You can watch the series on HBO in the US, Binge in Australia. It's all there now, all 7 episodes. Subscribe to the feed so you don't miss a minute of our coverage, which is highly entertaining. postshowrecaps.com/HBO. And if you have a moment to rate and review, it makes a huge difference. So let's just dive straight in. I don't know how else to attack.
They certainly did.
But I said this to you before we started recording. Don is the best character. Don the lawyer, late Serge, turns out to be the best character in a completely different television show from everybody else.
Yeah.
And not only the best character, he becomes the main character in this episode. What are your thoughts on that?
There's something about the folksy Southern lawyer, you know?
Yes.
There's something to be said about it. And I know that they're probably going from, the actual testimony that was given, the actual words that were recorded by the court reporter and all that, and then, like, giving it some dramatic flair. Did I expect that to be the case for him to become the main character in a episode where Elizabeth Olsen's Candy is testifying for her life? No, I did not. But that's what happened. And you're right that it seems like a totally different show. It's just very odd to me.
It's strange. It's as if David E. Kelly... Hi, David. Still waiting for that apology. It's as if he... This is the character he was really interested in.
Right. Typically from David E. Kelly type shows, this is totally in his wheelhouse of characters that he cares about. So that makes sense. But the show is not, the show is not about Don. It just kind of became about him in this last episode and what he was able to accomplish. So,
and you know, to some extent, the previous two, but it just sort of completely flowered in this one.
Score one for attorneys, I guess.
Yeah. Well, he's telling Candy, do not hold anything back. So we'll see if she does. And there are protesters outside the courthouse, which I don't understand. Like, the machinery of justice or otherwise is in motion inside the courthouse. I don't know why you would stand outside with signs. But presumably this is also correct. The one I liked was "Axe God for forgiveness."
Yeah, that was good.
I thought it was good, and I suspect is not true, but that was one for the writers. It did make me laugh.
Yeah. Very ironic that they are holding up signs as all the writers are currently holding up picket signs.
Exactly. We are on this podcast in favor of the writers. None of this happens without writers. So, as you say, Candy is called to the stand. We have a strange shot of Alan and Pat sitting in a hallway on the same bench, a few meters from each other, staring ahead. I thought, well, okay, why are you just giving me this shot? Are they going to do something? Are they going to glance? Are they not? I don't know. There were a few kind of shots in this episode where we just looked at things, which is fine, and I quite like that, particularly in the early going. Let's just look at the kitchen, or let's just look at things. But we're in the finale now. Why are we stopping to look at things? One of the things we looked at was the court artist holding their pencil incorrectly. So cut that shot, David, because anybody who is an artist or knows an artist knows that they weren't holding the pencil correctly. When you sketch with pencils, you don't hold them in the same way that you write with pencils. Just saying that there's a few little things that could have been sorted. I'm trying not to get to Candy's testimony, but let's get to Candy's testimony. And guess what, LaTonya? We watch the murder again.
Yeah, so this, I knew that we were going to talk about this, and so I'm glad that you're bringing this up. We talked in the last episode about how out of place we found those kind of like gruesome recreation of images to be of Betty's body. And the only thing that we kind of like gave that moment was, well, maybe they're not going to do what Candy, the other series that did exactly this same thing, did, which is show us the fight between the two women that actually occurred. But no, we saw it anyway. So I really don't know what the point was of just seeing all of those images when at the time we said that just the people describing it was enough. And if we were going to see the fight scene happen again anyway, then we were going to see all of like how the gruesome imagery got there. So I'm not really sure what they're going for with this. We know how gruesome an axe murderer is.
Yes,
we get it.
You just have to say axe murderer and immediately, you know, you shudder with even the thought of it, you know, in the abstract. We saw the murder already in one of the earlier episodes, not as detailed, but mm-hmm. we saw the axe, we saw the blood flow, we saw, then as you say, we heard it described in the courtroom. Then we saw the photos and now we see the murder again. It's like, yeah, we got it. You're the one who should ask God for forgiveness. Pick a lane.
Yeah. This show, I think, was really a little bit confused about what kind of show it wanted to be.
Yeah.
Because obviously it wanted to be at some times not particularly raunchy, but just kind of like a show about two people, like middle-class people having an affair, right? At other times, it was a show about the lack of connection that can come to married couples after they've been together for a long period of time. Then they wanted it to be a courtroom procedural, and now they want it to be a gruesome showing of the murder that actually took place, I guess, to have us sit with the weight of all of it. But again, pick one lane and just like go for that. And then I think the audience will like this show way better as a result. I'm now at the point where I don't know why this got made.
Yes. I mean, we have mentioned the series Candy, which came out in May last year. And we've been quite restrained in comparing, although it's hard not to compare and mm-hmm. we don't. You know, hold back, but we didn't want to bang that drum every minute of every episode.
Right.
But here I'm thinking back to Candy and why Candy was so much better. For a start, it was shorter. 5 episodes really distilled mm-hmm. what the makers of the piece wanted to say. And it was stylized. This is stylish, right. But Candy was stylized. So you said sit with it. I mean, we sat with more stuff with Candy, I think, than we ever have here. Here I'm sort of repelled. Stop making, what do you want me to think? Whereas with Candy, we were drawn in. And one of the things that they did was not show the murder until the time was ripe.
Mm-hmm.
And we would do things like look at the outside in a long day while Betty was dead and the baby was there alone. We would just return and just look at the outside of the house.
Right.
Now, I talked before about why you just looking at things. I love just looking. I love it when a filmmaker just says, just look at this.
Yeah.
Because we know it's the story of one woman who axe murdered another. Because we know that Jessica Biel, you know, fled the scene mm-hmm. with her marvelous perm. And we just look at the outside of the house in silence. And it was so powerful. So powerful. Here, I think you're absolutely right. It was like 5 different shows in one. And the other thing I would say is when Candy came out, or when you knew, you, David E. Kelly, and HBO, knew that Candy was coming out, why did you pursue this? If you both came out at the same time, you'd think, okay, you were too far gone. But this is almost a year later.
Right. I mean, I think that maybe they had gotten farther along in the process than we know.
Right.
Because when Candy came out, we knew that Love and Death was going to happen.
That's true. That's
so, like, true. The casting at least had been done, and maybe some of the shooting, or maybe all of it had been shot, and they just waited however long to actually release the show. But I think they were trying to kind of catch lightning in a bottle by Big Little Liesifying the show. Mm-hmm. Because everyone in this version of the Candy Montgomery saga is what I'm going to call it, seems a lot richer, a lot more comfortable, a lot more leisurely in their pace about things than anyone did in Candy.
Yes.
So I just don't think that it, I don't think that they achieved exactly what they were going for. And it, so much to the point that it muddled what we did get.
Because there were things that we liked about this series. And yes, I am using the past tense. Yes.
It's over.
So Don shows Candy, Don the lawyer, the defense lawyer, shows Candy the axe and she cries.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, okay. But I will say that later, she asks him, why did you show me the axe? And he says, because I needed you to show emotion. And I said, thank you. Yeah, I got it. I yes, I got it when it happened. I got it when it happened.
I know. This felt like speech writing 101. Any communication major out there will understand what I'm talking about. Because the number one rule of speech writing 101 is tell them you told them, and then tell them you told them you told them, right? That is not how you write a script or a screenplay. we don't need, it's just another example, like along with seeing the murder and seeing the crime scene photos. This is another example of us being told that we were told something that even if you weren't paying very much attention and you had this on in the background, you already know why.
Yes. I mean, surely there could be a different interaction where she berates him for making her emotional. Now that scene's about something else. But to just say, why did you show me the axe? Yeah, we already know why. So Don and Pornstache, I can't remember that character's name, the criminal lawyer, they argue about whether the jury is with Candy or not. And I thought, well, all right, if you're going to give me the courtroom procedural, dig into this scene more. It was so brief. I thought, why are you arguing with each other? And what are the impressions that you are each getting of the jury that you are reading differently? And I mean, I found this interesting, but it could have been interesting. Both lawyers are on the same side. They're both on the defense. They both want Candy to be found not guilty. And again, we've said this before, Latanya, we wanted to see what, if you're going to have the camera look at things and make us look at things, let us look at the jury. Let us look at the jury. We don't get any moment of understanding who these people are. I mean, anyway, the interesting line there was the media doesn't make the decision. So the idea that the media is very anti-Candy, as we know from, we've had the scenes of stand-ups of the TV presenters and the picketers outside the courtroom. Not sure what they're doing. Their signs were too well made, by the way. I have loved the set direction and props making in this show. So that would be my one ding, that they were very much sign painterly. Let's move to Candy's kitchen, where we've spent quite a lot of the last seven episodes.
Yeah.
She's loading the dishwasher. Fine. And who should appear but Candy's mummy? Latanya, what was going on here, please? I thought, oh, it's the ghost of her mother. No, but her mother's still alive.
Her mother's still alive. I think that we were just supposed to see, this was supposed to show us what the trial is like doing to Candy psychologically and how it must be difficult to like live with yourself when you feel that you have blood on your hands. Because there's literally blood on her hands. So,
do we care?
I this would have been way more interesting if her mother were actually dead, but her mother wasn't. they talk about her like in the next scene that she has with her husband. She talks about having spoken to her mother.
Well, give me that. Give me the conversation. How's
your relationship with your mom now?
Yeah. How do you, as a grown-up woman with a grown-up daughter, reconcile? And now that she said she did it.
Right.
I mean, the only question before the court is not whether she did it or not. It's whether it was self-defense or not.
Right.
How do you speak to your daughter? I mean, Pat, we do get, there's a moment where you think, yeah, he didn't want her to get off. Like he's wonderful, Patrick Fugit. Wonderful, wonderful performance. Very understated. And there's this moment where, sorry, I'm jumping ahead now. She's going to be found not guilty. And we look at his face. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just this moment where you think, oh, like, he's thinking, and now I have to live with her.
Yeah, now I have to go home and live with this woman.
Yeah. So if you're going to bring in the mother, show us the conversation that you refer to. She can still imagine she's got blood on her hands. The thing is, there's been no, apart from the camera just loving this actress, and we love looking at Elizabeth Olsen. Mm-hmm. And I mean, she has a face you could just look at and project anything onto.
Yes.
But that aside, there hasn't been a lot of interiority with this character.
No.
And suddenly in episode 7, we're getting the ghost or the dream of Candy's mother appearing in a kitchen, giving her a knife, and there being blood on her hands, and then her waking up from a nightmare screaming. It's like, but
Yeah, one of the issues that I had with this adaptation as well as Candy is that despite this being kind of a salacious tale, there doesn't seem to be a lot of there, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I still don't understand why Alan and Candy had an affair. I still don't. It doesn't make any sense to me. Why they stopped. Those two people in both this show and in Candy exhibited negative spark. No chemistry of any kind in either of the series. And no reason to make you believe that Candy was starting to get feelings for him, for Alan. So that didn't make any sense.
It was so manufactured.
Yeah.
We didn't see it in Candy, but it was sort of slightly manufactured here. But then there's an insistence that she didn't kill Betty out of jealousy or wanting Alan or anything like that.
Like, so why did you have this affair other than boredom? Like, I understand that in the South, people get bored and they have sex. Like, it happens all the time.
Like, who doesn't?
Yeah, but like, especially when you're in Wiley, Texas, like, what else are you doing? Mm. But it just seems like there would be some there. And in the same way that there's no there in terms of interiority for Candy. Like, what drives this woman other than making food for other people?
So, I mean, I think that you say this is a true story. You completely trap yourself as a creator. But if you said based on a true story, you know, you would have had more leeway to explore, you know, the perfection of the suburban woman in the late 70s and 80s, or the bleakness of extramarital affairs where it's a decision out of boredom and not, you know, passion. Or like there's a whole lot of ways you can go. And if you say it's based on it, even if you call them all by the same names, you give yourself a little bit of leeway, and I think that's what this show did not give itself.
Right.
So it's trying to manufacture our thoughts towards Candy or Pat or Alan or we don't get a lot of Betty, so hard to know. And to me, it doesn't work. So there we go. We will talk later when we wrap up about what did work, and there were things that worked, and we'll get there. But we would be doing a disservice to our listeners if we didn't.
Yeah, but thing that I've noticed in watching the Discord throughout the entirety of like us recording this and like watching this show is that the people on the Discord are very much with us in terms of why did this get made. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a podcast called Why Did This Get Made? And yes. I think that this is a perfect show for them to, because I just don't get it. I really don't get what this adaptation brings that we didn't get from Candy. I really don't. I don't understand why these two people had an affair. I don't understand why, like, the difference or not difference that Marriage Encounter made. I don't understand the murder. I don't understand the murder.
But see, that's very interesting, because it's the same in Candy. We don't understand the murder. So make that the central void. Don't make Candy the central void. Make them, we don't understand it. And what this show does incorrectly, in my opinion, is it shows the murder according to Candy's story, as if it's how, as if it was how it happened. That Betty got the axe, that Betty attacked first. I thought when we started to see the murder again that we were going to see a different version. That would be really interesting.
Yeah.
But first time she told the story, it was Betty got the axe and said this to her.
Right.
And then when we see the murder again, we see what really happened, which is that she got the axe or something. Or
but legally, something. This is what really happened, because once a jury does like a fact finding and decides that someone acted in self-defense, then whatever story was told up there becomes the truth.
Well, that's why you do based on rather than. I mean, this is the thing that we say that, excuse me, that Candy, the show Candy, showed the murder. But if you haven't seen it, what is brilliant about it, it's in media res. We see it while they are in the midst of it. We don't see what started it. We don't see who picked up the axe. They both reached for the gun. You know, we don't see how it was incited. We just see it and the physical. And when we've spoken of this before, the physical tussle of the two women. And I think that was very clever, because despite, as you say, the legal truth is that it is, as Candy said, it still left much more of a void where the answer should be. And I like that. I like that kind of bleakness where we don't always know. We can't always know our own or other people's motivations. Let's take a brief pause. We're going to clean our empty kitchens and we're going to be right back. Oh, I just saw the ghost of my mother in there. It was shocking. And she really is dead, so I'm allowed to see her
ghost. Yeah, you can. You can totally see the ghost. If I saw the ghost of my mother, it would just be my mother.
Yes. And my kitchen never is that clean. So now Pat is on the stand. Pat, Candy's husband, in case you'd forgotten, in case he'd receded into the background. And he blames himself and forgives Candy. And I thought, thank you. Thank you, actor. Thank you, storyteller. Thank you for giving me this moment. I would have liked, again, to have seen the jury as they looked at the husband of the murderer, taking the blame on himself, forgiving Candy, loving Candy. But I thought this was a really nice moment in this episode. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that Patrick Fugit has been great in this. This is kind of a side of him that I've never seen before in terms of the roles that he's taken. Just kind of like a middle-aged, boring suburban dad. And I think that he's done that really well. And for, you know, to know that of everything that's happened, that Pat blames himself for it. Maybe because that makes it a lot easier for him to sleep at night, knowing that he's sleeping next to someone who axe murdered, you know, her friend.
Yeah. So he either blames himself or he is coming to the party and saying that he blames himself because Don set him up for it. We don't know. Don gets held in contempt of court again, and I wonder why. Why? He's not the main character. This is main character thing. It's like, you know, anyway. So he's gonna go to jail, and we'll see him go to jail, and that's fine. It's fine. It's fine. So Don calls witnesses to badmouth Betty, especially bad pastor. Too late. If you wanted me to know anything about Betty, you had 6 episodes to tell me. Particularly 1 and 2. But no, You didn't tell me before, it's too late. So after the proceedings closed, Don goes to jail for his contempt of court. Why? We see him giving up his watch.
Why do we see this? Like,
giving up his money clip. Why? Why are we
seeing and the fingerprinting. It's just kind of like we know what happens when someone gets held in contempt of court. We know what happens when someone goes to jail.
You know?
And then only for him to immediately be called and like have a call put in so that he could immediately get out.
Why? This is the main. If he's the main character,
yeah,
then these scenes make sense.
Yeah.
So Mrs. Don picks him up from jail. She's not happy.
No. She basically says, you're going to have to live with these decisions after all of this is over. And he's like, I don't need this right now.
You're not the main character, Don. God love him. Don thinks he is, and rightly so, and we should all think we're the main character. It's just that the people filming our life story shouldn't necessarily agree with us. So Alan's watching the news, sitting on his sofa, very potato-faced. Wonderful Jesse Plemons. I cannot get enough of him. And who should be sitting supportively on the sofa with him? It's the blonde neighbor lady with the casserole.
Mm-hmm.
And she's come for a little smoochy smooch.
Yeah.
Scandalo.
Now, I'm more than happy to talk about how ridiculous this is, because this actually happened in real life. We learn that not only did he start dating the neighbor, but that they got married, and then he kind of gave his kids to his in-laws.
Yes.
And then they got divorced, and then he got remarried and started on family number three. So, like, just thinking about how easy it is to replace a person in your life is wild. Like, the trial is still happening from your wife having been axe murdered by your ex-lover. And you have decided that it's time to move on with the woman who keeps bringing you food.
Well, a man's got to eat. You're telling the story of my grandfather.
Really?
His first wife died, my grandmother, very young. And he married and divorced someone pretty quickly. And then my second step-grandmother, who I did know, who was marvelous, she came as the housekeeper to look after the children.
Oh,
and quick smart, got married, two more children, and outlived him by, let me say, so he died before I was born. So she outlived him by 40 years.
Oh, wow.
She was fantastic. But yes, it's this idea that a man with children cannot manage.
Right. Yeah. Especially and so therefore in that day
woman,
and age.
Yeah. Yeah. So a woman must be brought in to look after the children. And then, you know, if she can step into the, according, this is my mother's view of my step-grandmother, you know, step into the role. That's why she took the job. I don't think so, but there you go.
I don't know. There's something to be said about the women who kind of rally around a man who's a recent widower, and the competition that takes place for that man. I mean, I don't know if you've ever watched The Sopranos.
Oh, yes.
But there, and I don't want to give too much plot away for people who haven't watched The Sopranos, but you should watch The Sopranos if you haven't.
You should. It's just like, what are you doing? If you're listening to this, you watch television. If you watch television, watch The Sopranos.
Watch
it's
The Sopranos.
Just do it.
And then thank us later. I'm gonna talk to Josh about getting some Sopranos related content on Post Show Recap.
Oh, come on.
But I said all that to say there is a character who has a wife who passes away, and there's basically a casserole off in the neighborhood.
Yes.
To see which of these like single women is going to end up with this man. And it happens all very quickly. He also has young children. And may not end up with the person that was best for him, but he definitely does end up with someone. And there is totally the idea of people seeing Alan as a catch. Like, he's got a great job. You know, he is single now, you know, because his wife was murdered.
By his ex-lover.
So why not? Why not have at it and throw your hat in the ring and see if you can make something work? And I guess it worked for Blonde Neighbor Lady.
It worked for her for a while. I mean, my critique of the scene is, you know, we start looking at the news and then we look at Alan and then we pull out and she's sitting there. I didn't need the kiss. I've seen Alan kissing people. I don't need it. I understand what it means right. that she is sitting so companionably uh-huh. on the sofa. Like there was no question even before the kiss about what was going on, but that's fine because apparently we need to be told no everybody. Chemistry. Yeah, exactly. Not a scary. It was a very dry kiss. But at least Candy taught him how to French kiss. Anyway, moving on. I wish we were talking about The Sopranos. It's such a good show.
I know.
It's also sort of foundational contemporary work.
It's very true. Like if you yes. love Mad Men, then you have The Sopranos to thank because Matthew Weiner mm-hmm. got his start writing for The Sopranos.
Yes. So yes. I'm just flashing to all sorts of images that come to one's head when you think about it. Characters. Anyway, we must move on. Closing arguments. And my notes here to you were closing arguments - everything we've already seen. There was nothing in the closing arguments that told us anything we hadn't already seen. We didn't need them. And let me ask you this. Don objects during the prosecution's closing arguments. And I, admittedly, very small legal knowledge, I didn't think you could do that.
You can. You can object. It's if you feel like something is like not being presented in the way that you have to present things during a closing argument, or if you feel like something is being brought in through the back door that is evidence that wasn't allowed in the trial.
Oh, okay.
And you're trying to like get it in through the closing statement, then you can object just for the record. And again, that's just setting more things up for appeal.
Right. Okay. Thank you for letting me know that. But yes, those closing arguments were nothing new. Alan asked the prosecutor how it's going. He says it's closer than I'd like it to be. Candy, now back at home, she's cooked some lunch. What is it? Salisbury steak. Yeah. I don't know what that is, but it sounds delicious.
Oh, Salisbury steak. It's just beef. It's just like a beef slice.
Oh, so it's cut almost, of beef. It's almost it's not like a sauce or something.
No, the Salisbury sauce is what makes it Salisbury steak. It's almost like meatloaf.
Oh, I love meatloaf.
It's very similar to meatloaf, only it's like kind of more broiled, and there's a special sauce like gravy that goes along with it.
Oh, yum. I want one of those. Next time I come, take me out. So Candy tells Pat, her husband, something he already knows, which is that Sherry has the children until the verdict. Thank you. I'm sure that was discussed prior to this particular moment. It's like they thought, oh, everyone would be wondering, where are the children? We have imaginations. We know they're fine. We know that
she killed them too. That's what her mother told her to do with that knife during that dream.
Steak is
just totally in Yellow Jackets territory now.
Yes.
In case you haven't noticed, on this finale recap, we're going to talk about better shows.
Yes.
Than we'll
give you a list of recommendations at the end. Yeah. So stand by for that. Pat says they have no chance of a normal life and will need to leave. Okay, that's fine. Yes, that is new information. I mean, it's something, again, we could have gleaned, but I was happy for that.
Apparently Candy couldn't because she was like, I just can't wait to go back to the supermarket again. Like, what are you talking about, lady? Candy.
If we were more engaged, that would have been a stunning moment where we had insight into her mind that she thinks everything's going to be fine once she's found not, once she's found innocent. Like I liked that she said they'll find me innocent and he had to very gently say, not guilty.
Yeah.
It's like, you're never going to get found innocent. Yes. Yeah, so, but again, by this point, we unfortunately, we can't rush through, we can't do 2X, but we're here hanging on grimly. Partly because I'm a completionist, not as much as I used to be, but also partly we owe it to you, the listeners,
yes.
who haven't been watching Love and Death. I was going to say Life and Soul, but that's not and are just tuning in to hear us being hilarious.
Honestly, it might as well be.
Honestly, sand and water. I mean, it could be anything. So the verdict is in. The judge instructs for no reaction, not guilty, which we knew right from the start. If you know anything about the case, I mean, you, the viewer, might have been watching it and trying not to Google. You mightn't have known, but anyway, not guilty. And as I say, Pat looks a bit scared and a bit disappointed.
Yeah. It always, I will, just to get, to take a quick step backwards to the closing arguments, I will always be floored by what passes as lawyering. Because, these are, I'm pretty sure, like, they just took the actual, like, court reporter's notes and, like, transcribed them. And this is what these people actually said. But the mere idea that this prosecuting attorney thought that that's all he needed to do in order to establish guilt is wild to me when there's so much reasonable doubt that exists in this case. And I will always, always, always be surprised by the types of closing statements that can win cases, especially in the South, especially in the South.
Well, as the prosecution also, you have what to me is a great advantage because you speak last.
Mm-hmm.
You're the last words that people hear before they go into the jury room.
Exactly. And I don't know. I was underwhelmed by both people. I mean, I thought that Don maybe had like a little bit more of a fire lit under him, but I was kind of underwhelmed by both and was really shocked at how little time they spent deliberating.
Yes. I mean, I wonder whether the judge's clear animosity for Don might have swayed them as well. Oh, they didn't give that nice man, you know, any leeway. Sorry for that accent, everybody.
No,
sorry,
that might way better than any Australian accent I would do. So.
But again, we didn't get that. We didn't get any of these kind of really crunchy, juicy thoughts. Anyway, it feels like the show wants to get it finished as well.
It does, doesn't it? How great would it have been to sit in with the jury and have this kind of be our, like, if the testimony on Candy's part is not going to take all that long, and it doesn't seem to, then what a great opportunity to get in there with some of the members of the jury and figure out exactly how they come to this verdict.
We should have got to the court episodes ago. We should have got to the court in episode 3.
Yeah.
And then had a complete sort of free-for-all. You can put a disclaimer at the end, scenes in the jury room are the creation of the or whatever, instead of an entire episode that we got, which was Alan and Candy meeting various times and multiple times to discuss whether they were going to have an affair or not. Anyway, so suddenly it's 8 days later. The Montgomerys are moving to Georgia. Sherry rocks up, always very happy to see Sherry, underused, so underused.
Yeah.
That's this actress. And they all get in the car and they drive. And Latonya, can you tell me where they go? Because they make a stop.
These clowns go to, they all pile in the clown car and they go to Alan freaking Gore's house. They go back to the scene of the crime. What? Like, Candy, like, I say this about people often in TV shows. I'll say that a white woman is white womaning.
Yes.
And the reason for that is because there are a lot of things that white women can get away with that, like, no one else can get away with. That's just kind of how our society has been built. And Candy white womans across this whole TV show.
Yes.
But this is truly a moment where I'm just like, what are you doing and how are you allowed to get away with this?
What in the actual white woman are you doing?
Like, you want closure here? So you think it's a good idea to go to Alan's home where you murdered his wife?
With your husband and children sitting in the car?
With your kids waiting for you.
So we've got one man in the car, one man at the door.
Right. And if this didn't happen, what a weird thing to shoehorn in.
Yeah.
Like, that's the other thing. It's just like, you have time to make this a thing that occurs, but no time to take us home with the foreman of the jury, the foreperson of the jury. Like, let us have a strategy session with the prosecution.
Yes.
You know, let us have more of a strategy session with the defense team other than them trying to figure out how to get a bail bonds person at the very beginning. Like,
let us see the jurors going out into the community and having to face people saying, you let that woman go.
Right.
I mean, what's the ripple? What? Here we go. Now I'm rewriting this entire series.
Do it.
You dispense with Candy and Alan and Betty in episode one, and then you make it the Don show. Mm-hmm. And you also add in the community ripples, not them holding signs, but a suburban wife and husband looking at each other. Could this person have an affair? I now know that people can have affairs. I mean, not that basic, but like what happens when the jury goes out into the community? As you say, the foreperson, presumably a man, goes home and his wife wants to know the details, but he can't say it. I mean, what are the effects? Because we can't know Candy, mm-hmm. because from both shows we realize there is in my opinion, probably some sociopathy there.
There's something going on.
So if we can't know her, we can know what happens in the community. That would have been very interesting. Anyway, that's not the show they chose to make, and that's fine.
Is it?
Well, it's not fine. Candy says she came to say goodbye, and he says, spectacularly, he says, okay. Oh, Jesse Plemons, I love you so much.
I know.
So our last view of him is behind the screen door saying, okay.
Okay.
So brilliant. She says, sorry. He says, sorry. They wish each other a good life. Back in the car, we pass the Como Motel, which she looks at. It's like...
Wistfully. Longingly even.
I don't know.
Like, I remember that place where I had the affair that led me to murdering Alan's wife.
Except it didn't because we'd already broken up and it was over. Ugh.
Do you have any, like, putting aside what is the quote unquote fact of the case?
Yes.
Why do you think this murder and how do you think this murder actually took place?
That's a very good question. I think that Candy wanted to kill Betty and she just killed her.
Okay.
I think much though I don't put a lot of stock into the hypnotist. I think the hypnotism scene was really good. I think she was faking.
Yeah.
But he does talk about dissociation and I would believe that. I don't believe it's from something that happened when you were six. I'm sorry. And somebody telling you shush. It's too simplistic. That's not the way we work. It's not one thing equals another thing. It's not mummy said shush when I was six and now Betty says shush so I kill her with an axe.
Right.
But there was something in the – they do talk a lot about the 40 wax and they say wax. You know,
yeah,
it's like,
they do.
It's not Lizzie Borden. But there's something in – I almost think of the word relish. So I think that something set her off, yes. I mean, she didn't go there to kill Betty. But she certainly got the idea of killing Betty and then she went through with it. That's what I think. And that's why it's unexplainable because even to herself, perhaps it's unexplainable.
Yeah.
What about you? What do you think happened?
I mean, I buy the idea that, especially because we get at the very 11th hour that Candy's sunglass frame, like not her frame, but like one of her pieces from her sunglasses was in the garage where the axe was kept. So it's very interesting how that got there and like no one, like it was brought up once and like no one ever talks about it ever again. She probably went in there and got an axe and maybe she had more feelings for Alan than she was letting on, or maybe something in her did snap on that particular day and time. And so she decided that she was going to kill a woman.
I mean, maybe it was not that she had feelings for Alan, but the fact that he broke it off.
Maybe, but why not kill Alan?
Well, you always blame the woman, don't you? You never blame the man.
Yes. Yeah. What am I thinking?
So we finished with on-screen text, at which point I threw my notebook to the ground. You lazy, lazy, lazy storytellers. If you want me to know this, put it in your show. If you want me to know this, put it in your show. Don't put on-screen text, you lazy. Anyway, so we get photos of the actual people, which was less interesting than it should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Alan, as you say, married twice. Candy and Pat divorced. Now, the star of the show, Don, interesting. He ran for governor of Texas in 1986.
Of course he did.
And died in 1998 of self-inflicted gunshot wounds. So, yeah, David E. Kelly, if you are so interested in Don, make a show about Don. I was listening to the Crime Writers On review of this show. They were much harsher than us, which I love.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and that was one of their points, is like, make it a show about Don. And I thought, yes, you've crystallized my own thoughts here.
Yeah.
And then Candy worked as a family therapist. So there you go.
With her daughter at one point.
With her daughter at one point.
Which is wild in and of itself.
Oh, LaTonya, tell me your thoughts on the season as a whole. I think it, the good and the bad.
So, I mean, I'll start at the beginning. It's a very good place to start. I was over the moon to cover this because I love Elizabeth Olsen, and she has been, you know, kind of like stuck behind a Marvel contract for years and hasn't really had the opportunity to do very much. But what she does is always intriguing to me. I'm thinking Ingrid Goes West as like one of the most interesting movies about social media and the relationships that you form over social media. It's just like really insightful. But she'll do these like little indie movies, right? When she does have the time to take a little time off from being the Scarlet Witch. And so, you know, then when she did WandaVision, I was like, just kind of blown away by her. So I knew that there were going to be two Candy Montgomerys in my life. I knew that I was going to watch the Jessica Biel version because Jessica Biel has kind of made a resurgence in terms of like true crime-esque television in her career. But I thought that this was going to be the superior version. Just looking at the cast that they assembled and, you know, not like Candy didn't also have a great cast. I mean, Melanie Lynskey, for goodness sake, played Betty. But just looking at the cast, I was like, and seeing that it was HBO and seeing that it was David E. Kelly, I was like, oh, this one is going to be much better. And we'll get into the interiority of the characters in a way that Candy did not. And then none of those things happened. In fact, I spent a lot of time convincing other people to watch this show, only maybe half-heartedly agreeing with all of the things that I said, but I wanted other people to witness this along with me so that I wouldn't be alone in all of it. And I have to say that I, after having finished this series and the supporting materials that came along with it, I do not know why they made this show. That's my review of it. Like, they could have just not and said they did. And then it probably would have been better. It
would have been the same because, you know, who, I don't know what the numbers are, but HBO will probably never tell us.
No.
I mean, we, in case this is the first of these you've listened to, sorry, I'm going to now do what the show did and say things that we've said over the last 7 episodes.
Yeah, I want to hear what you have to say. Like, what are your thoughts about this show overall?
Well, I'm going to start with the few things that I liked, and then I'm going to go overall. So
okay.
The set design is incredible because what it did was, one of the faults of some period stuff is they say, okay, it's set in 1980. So absolutely everything from the furnishings to the things that people use to the clothes they wear and the handbags they carry is going to come from 1980. This is not our lives. In 1980, you will have a table from the 50s. You will have cutlery from the 60s. You'll have something, a tablecloth from your grandmother from 1920. And people don't always wear the newest, latest clothes. And particularly in the suburbs, there's a kind of uniform that nobody wants to stand out, which is why a character like Sherry is great, because she's standing out with her hair and her makeup and her clothes. What the set decorators, the art direction, the costume designers, the hair and makeup did with this show was fantastic. This is actually a knock, because if the best thing about your show is the design, you've got a problem. But I would like to say, like, every object was so thoughtful. Don has an extraordinary office where he's got taxidermied things, and he's got a desk with a almost terrarium of taxidermy. I mean, wonderful, wonderful stuff. That was good. We've said again and again how much we like these actors. The cast is uniformly good. It's not Don Attorney's fault that he's in a different show. That's something that the director needs to take care of. Mm-hmm. And as I said in episode one, this is a director that I really like.
Yeah.
And David E. Kelly is a showrunner that I really like. So let me say, those are the things that I particularly liked. And overall, the word why. Like, not just why, because we already had Candy. I mean, you can have two shows about a tidal wave. You can have two shows about an earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
You can have two shows about Truman Capote. But leaving that aside, I still say why. What was it that intrigued you, the creator, about this? And if it wasn't exploring Candy, then why are you doing
it? Yeah.
It's not enough just to say fact, 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 fact. This happened, that happened, that happened. Dateline will give us that.
Yeah, that's true.
So, and I will also say, those who've been paying close attention, is that we held our nerve for five episodes. We did give you critiques, Tanya and I both, through the five episodes, we did give critiques. We were being very measured. And then the last two episodes, we basically lost our ish. Because all the leeway that I'd been giving the show, because of the great design, because of the great actors, because in every episode there was a moment or a scene or a glance or something that I thought, wow, that is great.
Yeah.
And because we had been mining for those and finding them for five episodes, by the time we got to episode six, it was like, nope. Done.
I know. And part of me feels bad about it, but part of me feels like it's what the show deserves.
Yes. I don't want to come on here and just crap on a show. We don't want to talk about shows that we don't like. We want to talk about The Sopranos. We want to talk about Yellow Jackets.
Yeah.
We want to talk about, and it doesn't even have to be highbrow. It can be middlebrow. It can be lowbrow. We like what we like. And it's really fun to talk about things that we like. However, the responses that I had to episode six were people really enjoying us not liking it. So
yeah,
apparently we make better episodes when we don't like it.
It's just, it's, you know, you're right in that there can be two adaptations of something, and they could both be very good for their own, like, individual things, or their casts are so different that they, you know, they stand apart from one another. But there was something about how this drug on. There was something about how there seemed to be no light behind anyone's eyes. I didn't. A lot of times you can feel a vibe coming off of, like, people when they're making something, and no one seemed incredibly joyous to be there playing these parts. And I get that they were dealing with very serious subject matter, but it's also subject matter that so many people are well acquainted with that you can have a little fun with it. And I think that the way the show tries to have fun with it is strictly through musical choices. Like, this was a jukebox musical of a true crime TV show.
I mean, including the incredibly poor decision of the theme music.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, I think too, just hearing you say you can have two shows about the same thing. If you think about the two Capote films, the angle was different. The ingress was different. Here, as with Candy, it's basically a straightforward, although Candy was more stylized.
Right.
It was a more straightforward, this happened, then that happened.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I will just talk about Jessica Biel and Elizabeth Olsen. I like them both very much.
Same.
It's, I mean, there's no objective measure of acting, but one could say that Elizabeth Olsen has a greater range, is a more nuanced actor. One could say that. I will say that.
It's, however, it's just true. She is a better actor.
She is. Jessica Biel, much more limited. However, her Candy was head and shoulders above Elizabeth Olsen's. I think that's the material. But I also think about Jessica Biel, and I think we've asked for interiority. She also had an impenetrable face somehow. And yeah. Yet I understood the interiority of Candy through Jessica Biel's acting and performance far more than Elizabeth Olsen's. You cannot lay that entirely at the feet of either actress, because they are in a show. There are many moving parts. There's editing, mm-hmm. there's directing, there's writing. But I really liked Candy. I really liked Jessica Biel's performance. And now, having seen another actress, whether it be Elizabeth Olsen or someone else, but interestingly, an actress who I think is really, really good, say the character, I now even more go back to Jessica Biel's performance and say, wow,
yeah,
it really was outstanding. So if you're going to watch anything, if you're only going to watch one Candy Montgomery, Betty Gore, Axe Murder show, watch Candy. Let Love and Death fall into some place where, as you say, just don't do it and say you did.
Yeah.
Consider becoming a post-show recaps patron. Quite apart from anything else, you get onto the Discord and hear LaTanya trying to make people watch this show.
You get harassed by me.
You get harassed by LaTanya to watch a show that she patently doesn't like. Get early access to podcasts as well as Patreon exclusive podcasts. Any level gives you access to the Discord as described. Merch is available at higher levels. You can't tell I'm reading a script, can you?
Mm-mm.
You can sign up at patreon.com/postshowrecaps or postshowrecaps.com/patreon. If you're just looking for merch, head to the store, postshowrecaps.com/store. That's your place to buy all your post-show recaps merchandise, including this week only, t-shirts, mugs, hats, bloody axes, taxidermied animals, cars, door knockers, and a man saying, okay.
Okay. Yes, you too can own Alan Gore.
You too can own Alan Gore. So LaTanya, what have you got going on and where can the people find you?
Well, not this anymore. A lot of things are ending for me, actually, so I'm a little concerned. So Versus is coming to an end because the last episode of, well, not forever, but for Succession versus Yellow Jackets, the last episode of Succession will air tonight as we are recording this. The last episode of Yellow Jackets aired on Friday, and I have still not recovered from it.
If you're not on the Yellow Jackets train, everybody in the sound of my voice, go and watch it.
Yeah, now is the perfect time to do so, actually, because if you've never seen it before, you've got 2 seasons to binge. And then God only knows how long it's going to take for us to get a season 3. But season 3 was approved before they even aired any season 2 episodes. So we're just going to have to wait.
I was so scared about season 2.
Really?
I thought, how can it be better and as good, and it's both.
It's really, really good stuff. So Josh and I are making those 2 shows fight and having some fun while doing it. It's going to be interesting to see what the matchup is going to be like this week, given everything that happened on Yellow Jackets, and I'm not even sure what's about to happen on Succession, but I'm nervous about it, I'll tell you that. And then, speaking of things that are ending, Barry is about to air its final episode of ever tonight as well. So it's really just me saying goodbye to TV shows tonight. Hopefully I won't cry too much. But Mike Bloom and I will be coming at you all as soon as we possibly can with the Barry final Barry recap of all time. So please stay tuned for that. And then, of course, I'm talking about Top Chef, with Kurt Clark and Haley Strong. Kurt and I, being Americans, are enjoying our 3-day weekend as much as we possibly can, being podcasters as well. last week was Haley's 3-day weekend. So we're getting the episode to you a little bit later than normal, but you'll be fine. I promise. And you'll enjoy it when you get it. Things coming up. We'll be doing an announcement show pretty soon for The Bear, because The Bear is returning, and Marissa Garza and I are going to come back along with someone else special that I can't reveal yet to talk about the upcoming season of The Bear. So please stay tuned for all of that information. I'm going to need something to do because everything is ending, Sarah. So if you want to figure out what I have going on, you can follow me on Twitter at LK Starks, or if you want to see pictures of me going to a nice wedding at the Adler Planetarium, which has one of the sickest views of the Chicago skyline that I have ever seen, then please follow me on Instagram at Stormborn1222. Sarah, what do you have going on?
Well, this is finished, so all done here. You can follow me at Sarah Carradine on Twitter. I'm covering Queen Charlotte, A Bridgerton Story, episode by episode, so with Sasha, Kirsten, Geneva, here on Post-Show Recaps. Also, the finale coming at you soon, we promise. So that's finished. What hasn't finished is that on reality TV wrap-ups over on RHAP Network, I co-host a weekly true crime review podcast. It's called Crime Scene, S-E-E-N, get it? I do that with the great Mari Forth and our wonderful guests. We just reviewed Victim Suspect with Rebecca Lavoy, and it's an incredible documentary.
Yeah.
It was great to talk about, but have some time while you're watching it to have your feelings about it. Mm-hmm. Latonya, I know that you really liked that as well.
Yeah, I did.
So we'll be talking about it. And Rebecca interviewed the director, Nancy Schwartzman, and the journalist that is at the center of the documentary, Ray De Leon. So she had some very interesting insights into it for everybody.
Lovely.
And on June 5th, I'll be live on the Crime Writers On Book Club, hosted by Toby Ball. So it's called Toby Ball's Deep Dive Club. We're talking about the book. I don't know why you're laughing. We're talking about the book Rogues by Patrick Radden Keefe, with Toby, of course, and Leah Sottile. So if you're into true crime, you will know Leah Sottile's name. I am so starstruck. I hope I will be able to talk. If you'd like to have access to that, as well as heaps of other Patreon-only shows, join the Crime Writers on Patreon at patreon.com/partnersincrimemedia. All right, so that is Case Closed on Love and Death. Catch Latonya and myself on another show very soon. Okay, bye-bye.